from the National Catholic Register. This is Register Radio, bringing light and clarity to the news and topics that affect your life.
As the Iran conflict enters its second full week, fear continues to grow that the loss of life and destruction might expand across the entire region. This week on Register Radio, Register contributor Ambassador Alberto Fernandez joins us with the latest on the situation. And then, Register staff writer Jonah McCowan joins us to discuss the debate over AI and ethics after a major AI company and the Pentagon get into something of a controversy, and for the use of AI in autonomous weapons and surveillance. Hello, I'm Matthew Bunsen, Vice President and Editorial Director of EWTN News and host of Register Radio, joined as always by my co-host Shannon Mullen, Editor-in-Chief of the National Catholic Register. How are you, Shannon?
Hello, Matthew. I'm well, thank you.
Well, it has certainly been a tense couple of weeks as the U.S. and Israeli militaries continue their massive assault on the radical Iranian regime. As casualties, both military and civilian, continue to mount. What do we need to know about the crisis, certainly from a Catholic standpoint, and what are the implications for the already beleaguered Christian populations in the region? Joining us, as he does in these types of moments, especially related to the Middle East and the Near East, is Ambassador Alberto Fernandez, who, of course, is a Middle East expert and a very frequent contributor to the Register. Ambassador, welcome back to Register Radio.
Thank you, Matthew. It's a pleasure to be on with you.
It was occurring to me this morning as I was looking at the latest from Iran that it would be nice to have you on Register Radio to talk about something fun, something light, and yet we're constantly bringing you on to talk about whatever the latest crisis is in the Middle East. So where are we at this point as we're recording this show heading into the weekend with the Iran crisis?
Well, it's only been a week. Some people may think that that's hard to believe, but it's only been a week. Certain things are clear. Certain things are not at all clear. I mean, there's so much happening. I would look at a couple of things that I'm focused on. As usual, there's like good news and bad news. A lot of bad news and some good news. Certainly, Iran's capacity to attack its neighbors has decreased. Every day has seen a decrease in the number of Iranian missiles and drones fired at his neighbors. By the way, the overwhelming majority of the drones and missiles that Iran has fired have not been fired at Israel. They've been fired at the Arab Gulf states, especially the United Arab Emirates, which has received 49% of all Iranian strikes have been on one country, the UAE, which is a remarkable figure. So Iran's capacity to hit others seems to be declining. I mean, it is declining if you look at it over the week. That's a good thing for the Americans and for the Israelis. Another thing which is happening, which is not so good, which is also seems to be heading towards some kind of inflection point, is the Arab Gulf states, which are major oil producers, are running out of space to store their oil. They're not getting their oil out through tankers, through the Persian Gulf, through Straits of Hormuz. And their facilities are all being, you know, oil storage tanks are filling up. They're having to shut down things they do. For example, they have large aluminum plants that rely on oil to produce aluminum. They produce like a quarter of the aluminum in the world is produced in the Gulf. So basically the war is having these second order economic effects, which will obviously raise prices worldwide. And we actually don't know where all this is going to go. So there's a ton of other things I could talk about, but we seem to be heading in certain directions, right? To kind of inflection points militarily, economically, and politically. And of course, the last thing I would say, and I'll let you ask more questions, the biggest thing probably is a tweet that we just saw from President Trump where he said that there would be no negotiations, but that what he wanted from the Iranians was unconditional surrender. And that raises the stakes immeasurably. One wonders what he's seeing that it would cause him to say that.
Mm-hmm.
Ambassador, these events, as you said, are happening so quickly, and you can scarcely, catch your breath on this. But for a moment, can we go back to June 21st of 2025, when the U.S. and Israeli strikes hit Iran's key nuclear enrichment facilities? Of course, Trump at that time said that those facilities had been, paraphrasing him, completely annihilated. What has happened between then and the beginning of this latest conflict?
Well, several things. Number one, of course, Iran has feverishly tried to recreate its capacity. Reportedly, they boasted to the Americans that they had enough material to make 11 bombs. That's the news report that says that in the negotiations that they had a week ago with Witkoff, supposedly they said that. So they feverishly tried to recover. They tried to recoup kind of whatever they lost last summer. They've also, I think these two other things have something to do with the war as well. Iran is also in a deep economic crisis because of the regime. So money's become almost worthless. Huge inflation, 50%, 66% inflation on food. And then, of course, there was the massacre in January of 2026 of tens of thousands of Iranian civilians protesting against the government. So those are all the things that have happened since June of 2025.
Ambassador, one of the questions that has been asked is, so what exactly is Iran's strategy? I mean, they're practicing, I guess, technically a form of asymmetrical endurance, but
yes.
How much of a pounding can they actually take, and can the regime itself outlast that?
Well, the regime strategy is actually very clear, because it's actually the same strategy that Hamas, that Hezbollah, that Iran itself have practiced years ago, and that is survival equals victory.
Mm-hmm.
If they can survive, they've won. They will declare that they've won. Now, as we've seen in both the cases of Hamas and Hezbollah, what happens is that strategy works. It's human nature to say, I survived, you did your worst, and here I am. But if the damage is so much, nobody buys it. So, for example, Hamas, after it launched this war in October 2023, nobody in their right mind thinks that Hamas won this war. Same thing with Hezbollah in Lebanon. Nobody in their right mind in Lebanon, actually 70% of Lebanese are furious that Hezbollah has entered the war again after what happened last. So the Iranian strategy of kind of survive and declare victory works only insofar as the damage is not too bad. The longer the war goes on, the worse the damage is, and the more difficult it is to pretend that you actually won.
So given the president's comment about the leader of Iran, that he wants control over that, how exactly, without putting boots on the ground, as they say, are we going to be able to dislodge the regime?
That's a good question. I can see the logic of this war. You know, all wars are terrible. All wars involve human suffering and tragedy and the loss of lives of innocents. But I can understand the political, geopolitical logic of this war from the administration's point of view. Lots of reasons why you would do that. What I don't know is the end game. And of course, this statement by the president raises the stakes, unless if he knows something that we don't know, something which is happening internally in Iran. It really raises the stakes on the end game, setting up the United States for a kind of disappointment that, well, you didn't accomplish everything that you wanted to do.
The Trump administration, ambassadors, frame this as a, maybe once in a generation opportunity for the Iranian people to direct the future of their country. But Iran doesn't need a navy or missile launchers to control its own citizens. So you know, how likely or unlikely is it that there would be some sort of meaningful uprising?
Well, the hope clearly is that if you put enough pressure on them, the regime will split, and that there are elements within the regime that will say, I want to make a deal, I want to change things somewhat, you know, a Venezuelan situation, right? The army, you know, in Iran has two armies, right? It has the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps and the regular army. The idea is that the army would rise up against the IRGC. I mean, this is pure speculation. As you said, the regime is really good at repression, and as we saw only in January. So expecting radical change through, you know, popular revolt, I mean, it's possible, but I would not bet on it. I think much more likely is a regime survives that is much, much weaker internationally, but still has plenty of repressive power internally. You don't need, as you said, you don't need missiles or drones to, you know, shoot people in the head, which is something that they were doing by the thousands just a little while ago. I think that's the biggest concern.
You know, what is the practical possibility of Reza Pahlavi actually returning to Iran and assuming the role of Shah again?
Well, there seems to be, it's a good news, bad news story, kind of. It's clear, given the events we saw in December and January, that he does have an audience. He does have a certain percentage of the population which is pro-monarchist. I mean, they were shouting, chanting, Javid Shah, long live the Shah, you know? So he does have a kind of demographic that favors him. It tends to be urban, well-educated Iranians, middle class, maybe upper class Iranians are the ones that seem to favor him. The problem is Iran is a very large country, and there's also a percentage of the population that are still fervent believers in the regime, in the Islamic regime.
Yeah. Go ahead, Shannon.
Ambassador, very briefly to wrap up, what are the lessons that Russia and China are taking from this conflict so far, do you think?
Well, it's not over yet, so maybe the biggest lesson hasn't been arrived at yet. But certainly, I think they have to be really impressed by American and Israeli technical ability to project power. And I think that's a big lesson for Russia, and especially for China, given its ambitions in East Asia.
Well, Ambassador, as always, thank you for your expertise. And I can pretty much guarantee, not to speak for Shannon too, but that we are likely going to have you on again in the coming weeks as this story develops.
Thank you so much.
Well, you're listening to Register Radio here on EWTN Radio. Next, we talk with Register writer, staff writer, Jonah McCowan, about Anthropic AI and the Pentagon. It's a standoff with fascinating ramifications for the ethics surrounding artificial intelligence. Stay tuned to Register Radio here on EWTN Radio.
Let's return to Register Radio on EWTN.
And welcome back. I'm Matthew Bunsen here, as always, with my co-host, Shannon Mullen, editor-in-chief of the National Catholic Register. Well, it isn't every day that a disagreement, a spat of sorts, between a major corporation and the Pentagon turns into an opportunity for a very serious debate about things like the ethics surrounding artificial intelligence. That is exactly what has happened with the decision on the part of Anthropic AI to sort of sever its ties, and that again has created more conflict with the Pentagon over the use of AI for autonomous weapons and surveillance. This is a developing story, of course, but Jonah McKeown has been following this story very closely and joins us now. Welcome back to Register Radio, Jonah.
Hi, Matthew. Great to be here again.
So let's bring everybody up to speed. What exactly is Anthropic AI, and why is this now the center of attention in the discussions about AI ethics?
Right. So Anthropic is one of the kind of the major players in the U.S. artificial intelligence apparatus, if you will. It's kind of alongside, you know, Google, OpenAI, which produces ChatGPT, and some of the other major players like xAI, which creates Grok. And it's a San Francisco-based public benefit corporation, so basically a B Corp. And it was actually founded by several people who previously worked at OpenAI, but left the company because they wanted to create something a bit more ethical. You know, an AI that has kind of baked into it, if you will, ethical standards, values, limits, and that kind of thing. And so really, it's positioned itself as kind of the ethical AI company, if you will. And up until recently, it actually wasn't terribly widely used. I mean, almost everyone has heard of ChatGPT and probably uses it most days. Not a whole lot of people had used Claude, which is the product produced by Anthropic, and does a lot of very similar things to ChatGPT. People use it for a lot of the same things. It's also used a lot in coding. So, you know, people who work in computer science and coding can use Claude to basically create whole new computer programs for them. But relevant to the discussion that we're talking about, Claude was actually the first AI company that was allowed by the Pentagon onto its classified networks. So the Pentagon has been exploring basically for the past year a lot of avenues for bringing AI into the defense space and using it for, you know, data analysis and just supporting military operations worldwide. And Anthropic, you know, despite being not quite as big as some of these other AI companies, because of its kind of safety and ethics forward approach, it had been able to make a lot of inroads into the Defense Department. That is until this recent dispute, which we can certainly talk more about.
Jonah, what do you think makes this a Catholic story and something that the Register would want to cover?
Right. So this is a story that we really jumped on because it has to do very much with the ethics of AI and how the development of this technology really ought to be guided by a set of values at some point. Now, obviously, as Catholics, we would want those to be Catholic values, right? And that is something that Pope Leo and Pope Francis before him really, really has pushed hard for. One of the guiding kind of documents that people should certainly read in full if they want to learn more about this is Antigua et Nova, which is a note from the Vatican's Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith. It came out in early 2025, so just before the election of Pope Leo, but he's really very much expanded on the information and exhortations that this note contains. But this note, Antigua et Nova, talks about how it's so important that in warfare, especially, you know, humans should be involved in the decisions of who to target and who to eliminate, if it comes to that, and computers should never be allowed to do that on their own. And that was one of the major issues that Anthropic had with what the Pentagon was asking them to do. The Pentagon wanted to have the option to use Anthropic's AI systems to basically take humans out of the equation and have the AI choose who to kill in warfare. And that is something that the Vatican has actually for many years spoken out against, because it's not something that computers should be allowed to do.
Yeah, and this is obviously something that has pretty severe ramifications, but it also looks as though, like, the Defense Department overall is trying to push and Anthropic to do this. And wasn't there the statement that the Pentagon had officially notified Anthropic that it is considered a, quote, supply chain risk, which would endanger it from doing any business with the U.S. government? So is there a way for these companies actually to resist without being potentially at great loss financially and in their positioning?
Right. That's a good question. And it's difficult to answer because this is a very unprecedented situation. No American company has ever been designated a supply chain risk under this law. And so it is interesting because in the last couple of days, I mean, this is a very much a developing story. Anthropic has said that they don't anticipate any huge impact to their business because of this blacklist. Because the way they read the law, it could be, fairly narrowly interpreted so that they don't basically suffer complete financial annihilation as they had feared originally. But it is difficult for these AI companies because there's a lot of money on the table. I mean, these contracts with the Pentagon and with the government are hundreds of millions of dollars, and so it's great when we see a company like this, you know, that basically exists to make money. It's good when they at least are trying to bring ethics into the equation, right? Because it could be the case that they just sign the contract and go on their way. But they are really taking a principled stand, and that's something you don't see every day from commercial companies.
Right. I guess the logical follow-up question to that would be, is it inevitable that this will happen? And if it does, especially in the areas not just of war, but of like national surveillance, what are the options for the average person?
Right. It's going to be something for everyone to be aware of and to be praying about, of course, because in terms of inevitability that you were asking about, it's difficult because these AI companies and the US government very much see themselves as in competition with other countries. Like China is developing very extremely powerful AI systems that they are already using to surveil their people. And so it's something that people need to be aware of because it is coming. I don't know if it's totally inevitable or not that these AI systems will be used for mass surveillance in the U.S. or autonomous weapon systems, but it's good that we're having this conversation because otherwise it might all be going on behind closed doors and we wouldn't know anything about it.
Yeah, we've all seen the science fiction movies and none of them seem to end very well.
Absolutely, that's very true, which is why it really does seem as though there need to be some kind of limits placed on AI. And obviously our Catholic faith provides some great ethical frameworks that we can use for that.
Real briefly, just to end here, is I know that there's the expectation that Pope Leo will issue some sort of a major document on AI. So we're watching for that. But as you spoke to the piece you wrote for the Register, spoke to various AI ethicists, including some Catholic voices. What was their take on this dispute between Anthropic and the U.S. government?
Right. I think the biggest takeaway was, again, kind of what I mentioned, that it's really notable and good that we are having a discussion in the public square about AI ethics, finally, because up until now, it's kind of just been a roaring freight train. Like the development of AI has just kind of continued so quickly, and we've seen these rollouts of these incredible new products that have changed people's lives and changed our economy and changed the education system in so many ways. And you know, so many of the people I spoke to, many of whom are Catholic AI ethics experts, they really appreciated the fact that there is a discussion going on about how can we make these AI systems work for the common good and assist human life to the extent possible, rather than just kind of steamrolling over human dignity. So, this particular case, as I mentioned, is still very much unfolding. There was some kind of breaking news that Anthropic might be back at the negotiating table with the Pentagon soon. And so I think it's again, something good for people to be aware of, for Catholics to be aware of, because it's an important discussion to have.
Well, Jonah, thank you. And I know that you'll be there every step of the way. We really appreciate your reporting on this.
Of course, anytime.
Well, that's it for Register Radio this week. Remember, for more news, analysis, and commentary, check out the National Catholic Register online at ncregister.com. Thanks so much for joining us. Until next week, on behalf of our producer, Michael McCall, and Shannon Mullen, I'm Matthew Bunsen. Please take care and God bless.